You're listening to a podcast by Pastor Fred Thompson at Mount Gilead Baptist Church.
Turn to the book of Ecclesiastes. Did last week's message in Ecclesiastes inspire anybody to jump into Ecclesiastes and start reading it? No one, okay? It's a difficult book in some sense. In some ways, it's an encouraging book, but in some senses, it's a discouraging book when you get in and really start reading it. So maybe you'll find some time to pick it up. Maybe pick up a real modern translation or paraphrase and read it. It'll just really begin to speak to your heart sometimes when you do that. There was a rich industrialist, and one day he made his way down to the fishing docks, and as he got there in the fishing docks, he noticed a fisherman, a professional fisherman, just sitting next to his boat, laid back, lazily lounging and relaxing. And it irritated him. And he goes up to the man and he said, "Why aren't you out there fishing?" And the fisherman said, "I've caught all the fish I need for the day." And he said, "But why aren't you out there catching more fish?" He said, "If you go catch more fish, you'll make more money." And he said, "Well, what would I do with that?" He said, "Well, when you get more money, you'll be able to buy a bigger boat. And when you get a bigger boat, you'll buy bigger nets and you'll catch more fish. And then you'll be able to hire more people and more boats and more fish and more nets. And you can just keep getting these things." And the fisherman said, "Well, then what do I do?" And he says, "Well, you're like me. Then you can sit back and take life easy." And the fisherman says, "I thought that's what I was doing." It's a vicious cycle. We spend our life trying to increase everything that we have, thinking that this next thing will make me happy. You know, it's true, isn't it? You know, if the kids were still in here, I'd hear this. The kindergartner kids will say, "I'm happy when I make it to the first grade." And the fifth graders will say, "Boy, I'm going to be happy when I make it to middle school." And the middle schoolers will say, "Boy, I'm going to be happy when I make it to high school." And high schoolers, "I'll be happy when I make it to college and get out. And then when I'm happy when I get a job and happy when I get married and have children." Do you catch the drift? Until one day we realize that we're at the end of our life and we've never reached that thing that makes us happy. Well, that's what Ecclesiastes is really about. That's what we looked at last week. This week we're going to look at the message, "Is meaning found in self-gratification?" Is that where we find meaning for our life at? Isn't that sort of an indictment on our society today? Our society goes after self-gratification. That's what they look for. They want to look for the things that please me, that make me happy. And that's exactly what Solomon is doing today as he begins to search into Ecclesiastes. Now, chapter 1 that we looked at last week gives an overview of Solomon's search. When we looked at that last week, it's sort of a introduction to the entire book. He sort of went through this and basically comes to the conclusion, you know, all these things I've tried are meaningless. It's just a vapor. It doesn't amount up to anything. But in Ecclesiastes chapter 2 and in the chapters following, we get to see Solomon dig into specifics as he began to search for the meaning of life and for the things that would bring him happiness and bring him purpose. Now, here's something I want you to notice. We're only going to look at the first 11 verses of chapter 2 today. And as we look at those first 11 verses, and I'll read them in segments. I won't read it all together, but I'll read it in segments. I want you to pay attention to how often the word "I" is used. Self-gratification. As a matter of fact, as you read through the entire book of Ecclesiastes, pay attention to how often the word "I" is used. Not only the word "I," but words that refer to the "I," like "myself." You know, they'll say, "me, myself, and I." Look for those kind of words that point toward that. Now, let's look at verses 1 through 3. "I said in my heart, 'Come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself.' But behold, this also was empty. I said of laughter, 'It is mad,' and of pleasure, 'What use is it?' I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life." Here's the first thing he decided to do. He decides to seek self-gratification through pleasure. Now, let me ask you this question. How many of you like pleasure? I'm going to expect 100% of you raise your hand, because my next choice is, well, how many of you like pain? All right? No, we like pleasure. And there's nothing wrong with pleasure. I hope you understand that. God created us to enjoy life. He created us for pleasure. But what Solomon starts doing here in chapter 2 is a thing that, it's a word that we use in our world today called hedonism. And what he does here is 100% hedonism. And this is what this is. It's the doctrine that pleasure is the sole or chief good in life, and that the pursuit of it is the ideal aim of conduct. In other words, what is life all about? Being happy, seeking pleasure, getting bigger things, working harder, making more money. That's the kind of thing that it does. It's going after pleasure, things that bring you great joy and great pleasure. Paul encountered that in the New Testament in Acts chapter 17 when he encountered the Epicureans. The Epicureans were a group of people that lived in New Testament times that believed that the spirit and the body were two separate things, and that what you did in the body didn't hurt the spirit. So, live it up in the body. You don't hurt the spirit when you do that. So they were known for pleasure seekers, for partying, for doing that kind of thing. So what he's doing here in this is basically an early doctrine for the Epicureans to turn to and follow what he's talking about in these first few verses. Now, let me ask you this question. I ask you how many of you like pleasure. How many of you like to laugh? I'd say 100% of us in here enjoy laughing, don't you? When you laugh, it brings a sense of joy to you. Actually, laughter is audible expression of pleasure. So the first thing he does is this. He seeks pleasure through comedy in verse 2. He says, I said of laughter. What did he do? He said about laughing. How would you like to have a comedian live next door to you? Don't you think sometimes that it would just be hilarious to have someone who is a natural comedian to live next to you, and you could always be laughing? How many times have you ever gone out with your friends and you've sat in a restaurant and you've laughed, and you've laughed till, you heard the saying, your side splits? You know, you just laugh and you cry, and you... I'm a very reserved person most of the time. But back in, before we left Florida, we had gone out with a couple of friends, and they knew that we were getting ready to make the move here to Georgia, and we were at Carrabba's, I believe, and we were eating, and something happened, and I don't recall every detail about it, but I got what my mom always called the silly giggles. And I was laughing so hard that I was just crying. And they were laughing at me because they'd never seen me do that before. And I just, it was just hilarious. Side-splitting laughter. That's what Solomon has done. He says, look, I went after laughter. I want to laugh. I want to feel good. It makes me feel good. But let me ask you this. Anytime you've ever been in that situation, when it's all over with and everything settles down, aren't you still empty? Isn't there still something that's missing? It filled a need for a short period of time, but then after the laughter's over, there's nothing there. Now, you and I could throw some parties and we could live next door to comedians and have a comedian come over every night and make us laugh. You know what? Solomon said, so what? Man, I could have any comedian I want come. I don't have to sit down and watch a sitcom on television. I have them come to my place. I can afford to do that. The best comedians, my palace and my temple, or not temple, but my palace, was Comedy Central. But you know what? When it was all over with, it was just emptiness for me. Well, the second thing he tried to do, he tried to find pleasure through partying. You know what? I think his palace must have rocked. If you look in verse 3, it just says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. Doesn't that sound like Hollywood today? You look at television, and that's, you know, around here, I don't know too many people that will throw those kind of parties. If y'all know them, let me know who they are. But not that I'm going to their parties. I just would like to be curious if there's anybody around here that has those kind of parties. I've never seen one around here. But in Hollywood, they throw these tremendous parties. I mean, people come from everywhere to be a part of these parties. And the alcohol flows freely. Drugs flow freely. They party and everything else. And then when it's all over with, they go home empty. And some of those people in Hollywood think, man, I've thrown a pretty big bash. I mean, if you follow anything on television, you've seen some of these actors and actresses that have gotten married lately at how much they spend on their wedding. You know, millions of dollars for their wedding. But after it's all over with, there's an emptiness. And Solomon is saying, look, you thought you could throw a party? Man, could I throw a party. I mean, it came with thousands of people to my party. We're going to see that here in just a second when we get down to the next section. But we're going to go back and look at a few verses in Kings. But he says, you know what? After all the partying, it was just emptiness. See, if you live for pleasure alone, here's what happens. Your enjoyment will decrease unless the pleasure increases. Did you catch that? If you live for pleasure alone, your enjoyment will decrease unless whatever's causing you to have pleasure increases. It's sort of the drug syndrome. The reason people get hooked on drugs is that when they try it, it makes them high. The next time they try it, it doesn't make them quite as high. So they need a little bit more. Or maybe they take it more frequently. And after a while, it doesn't do anything for them except that they can't live without it. And they find themselves empty. And that's what pleasure does to you. The intensity decreases unless the pleasure increases. So he says, pleasure didn't work for me. I tried it, but it was emptiness. It was vanity. It was that meaningless thing in life that's just a vapor and temporary. Well, then he tried self-gratification through possessions. Look with me at verses 4 through 8. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. And those eight verses, actually through the first part of that eighth verse, he seeks for self-gratification through possessions. Now, how many of you enjoy owning things? I'd say that's, again, every one of us in here. You see, it's not the owning things that we're talking about here today. What we're talking about is that is the only goal in your life, just like pleasure. Pleasure becomes the only goal in your life. The first thing he tried was this, building and owning real estate and homes. That's what he tried from in the very beginning. It took Solomon Solomon was the one that built the temple after David. Solomon built the temple. You know how many years it took him to build one of the seven wonders of the world, the temple with all of its gold and everything else? 7 years. Then Solomon built his palace. You know how long it took Solomon to build his palace? 14 years. That gives you an idea of how much he put into just building things, owning real estate and homes. How many of you have ever been to the Biltmore Estates in Asheville? A few of you have. If you haven't, maybe you've seen pictures. Huge house, isn't it? I can't imagine taking care of that. Well, here's another house that I ran across when I was looking at this. How many of you ever heard of Bill Gates? Bill Gates, the founder of Microsoft and probably one of the wealthiest men, if not the wealthiest man in the world. Listen to this. He has a large mansion on the side of a hill overlooking Lake Washington in Medina, Washington. Now get this, it is 66,000 square feet, 1.5 acres is the house. It has 7 bedrooms, 24 bathrooms, which includes 10 full baths, 6 kitchens, and 6 fireplaces. It has 500 waterfront space in front of it, overlooking the lake. I ran across some place, and I never could find it to write the number down of how many people he employs just to keep his house up. It's the most technologically advanced house that there is. I mean, there are no visible outlets in any room. Every room is equipped for wireless. I guess you'd expect that from Bill Gates, wouldn't you? It's built on a side of an earthquake zone, so it has concrete piers and tiebacks and steel reinforcements several times stronger than the minimum set by the building code. In other words, he said the building codes is this minimum for an earthquake zone. I'm going to make it even stronger. It says that over the past decade, Bill Gates has quietly bought up 11 properties, including 9 houses that surround his 5-acre Medina estate, creating a buffer zone so that eventually he's going to have this place that's just isolated from everybody. Amazing. He just keeps building. He just keeps buying. That's what Solomon was doing. But can I tell you something? If you had brought Solomon and shown him Bill Gates' house, Solomon would say, "That ain't nothing. You should have seen my palace, covered in gold." Silver was even looked down on. You know, we'd like to have silver in our house. He looked down on silver. Gold was what he wanted in his house. Well, not only was it buying property and real estate and building homes for Solomon, he tried that. In verse 5 and 6, it says he planted and tended gardens and parks and forests. You know, I've known a lot of people in my life that just said, "I can't wait till I retire because I'm just going to spend my time gardening. I'll spend my time landscaping around my house. I just love getting outside and working." I've got a sneaky suspicion when we get to this next one that Solomon probably didn't do a lot of the work. But he did. He planted a lot of gardens. Callaway Gardens is one of the closest ones to us. Beautiful place. We're approaching springtime, and if you've ever driven through Callaway Gardens during the spring, it's just flowers everywhere. Beautiful to drive through and just see nature. Well, Solomon built some forests and some gardens and some parks that he probably would look at Callaway Gardens and say, "That ain't nothing." As a matter of fact, they still, outside of Jerusalem and some of those areas, there's a place called Solomon's Pools. And it's an area in which there are just holes dug in the ground. And they were dug in the ground for the express purpose of collecting water to water his gardens and his forests and his parks. Immense. And yet, he said, it didn't mean anything. It didn't do anything for me. Verse 7a, it talked about him having slaves in his household that were born in his household. I just said this, he had a lot of workers. In other words, Solomon had a lot of leisure time. You know, he didn't have to go out and take care of anything. He had someone right there in his household to take care of it for him. Some of you ladies would love that. When it came time to do the laundry, you wouldn't have to. You just call them and they'd come take care of it. Some of you guys want your car washed. You just call your workers in and they go out and work your car. You can just sit back, play your Wii games, or watch football on television. You know, you could just relax. Leisure time. He had somebody to take care of everything. They estimate that there was maybe 15 to 35,000 people who were around Solomon taking care of his things. And we'll see that in just one more second. We're almost there. I'm telling you, you're going to see how rich Solomon really was. 7b, the last part of verse 7, says he tried owning farm animals and pets. He had Atlanta Zoo right there in his house. He tried everything. He had all kinds of things that you could think of, and he found them to be emptiness. Then in verse 8, the very first part of verse 8, it says this, "I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces." He had a lot of money. It was unbelievable the money that Solomon had. If you want to keep your finger there in Ecclesiastes, if you just flip back to 1 Kings chapter 4, I'm going to read some verses here in 1 Kings chapter 4 that maybe will just help you understand how wealthy Solomon was. Beginning in verse 20, "Judah and Israel were as many as the sand of the sea. They ate and drank and were happy." Now what that tells me is this, boy, Solomon was throwing some major parties. Even the whole land was happy with what was going on. It was just a lot going on. "They ate and drank and were happy. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon all the days of his life." Now listen to this. "Solomon's provisions for one day was 30 cores of fine flour." Now, from what I understand, a single core was about 6 bushels of flour. So multiply that times 30. 30 times 6, 180 bushels of flour. And 60 cores of meal. Wow. I mean, they had cornbread and biscuits. in abundance. That sounds like my kind of food. 10 fat oxen, 20 pasture-fed cattle, 100 sheep, besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. That means Tyson's premium chicken. Listen, when Solomon pulled them together, provisions for one day is beyond our imagination. They estimated that this, and I said this earlier, I was going to get to this in a second, 15 to 35,000 people were fed every day in Solomon's house and his palace and everything. For he had dominion over all the regions west of the Euphrates, from the Tifsa to Gaza, over all the kings west of the Euphrates. And he had peace on all sides around him. And Judah and Israel lived in safety from Dan even to Beersheba, every man under his vine and under his fig tree, all the days of Solomon. Now listen to this. I told you he had pets and animals. Solomon also had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. Incredible. And it just goes on to describe more of the things that Solomon owned in possessions. And you know what it happens when he gets to the end of talking about possessions? It's simply this. All was meaningless. It just didn't do anything for me. The last part of verse 8 said this, even though I've already read this. It said, I got singers, both men and women. He tried entertainment. He thought entertainment would bring him happiness. Now, when you and I want to listen to singers, you know what we do? We either go to the radio and turn on the radio, or we pull out our MP3 players, or we connect on the internet to something that has music on it, or maybe we still use a CD or rarely cassettes. But whatever it is we use, we plug it in and we listen to music. You know what? Back then, they didn't have MP3 players, and they didn't have any kind of radio station or any kind of television station. So our entertainment, you know what Solomon did? He brought them in live. I mean, if you wanted to hear the best group in the Israel, Solomon just called them and said, hey, come on to the palace. You're playing this weekend. He brought them all in. And yet, it didn't do anything for him. Let me ask you this question. If I were to ask you this, who would you consider the most famous playboy? Who would you answer? Hugh Hefner. All right? Can I tell you something? Solomon made Hugh Hefner pale. Because what he said in the very next thing is, after the singers, he said, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. In other words, sensuality. Self-gratification through sensuality. Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, if you add those two together, that's 1,000, the best I can count. And if I were to divide that by 365 for the number of days in a year, you know what that means? He never saw the same woman over once in every 3 years. If he saw one every day. Now, you can't find any playboy that can do that. Solomon sought for that, and you know what? It still brought him emptiness. It still didn't do anything for him. Then verse 9a says this, so I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem, and also my wisdom remained with me. He surpassed all. He sought gratification through fame. You know, throughout the book of Ecclesiastes, what you find is Solomon saying, I'm better than you are. I'm wiser, I'm more powerful, I'm richer. But all in the end, it brought him nothing. He tried that, and it didn't do anything for him. He enjoyed his work. He planted all the gardens. It brought him fame. But that wasn't what brought him happiness. And the last part of that verse I just read says this, also my wisdom remained with me. It says, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. He tried self-gratification through restrained pleasure-seeking. It says in two places in here, way back up in about verse 2, it said that my heart still guiding me by wisdom. When he was talking about all the partying that he was doing, he said, I still did this with my eyes open. I didn't just turn loose and let the partying go. he says down here at the end, I didn't try all these other things, you know, seeking pleasure. I still kept my wisdom. I still kept my eyes open. I restrained a little bit what I did, but he didn't restrain much, because he said, all my eyes desired, I didn't keep from them. If I saw it, I took it. If I saw it, I wanted to do it. Nothing was held back. And here's his conclusion in verse 11. In verse 11, he said this, then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it, and behold, all was vanity. There's that word again, meaningless. It was a vapor. It was temporary. It was like the breath, and it's gone. It didn't do anything for me. And a striving after wind. You ever tried to chase the wind? And there was nothing to be gained under the sun. He said, I did all these things. I sought pleasure. I built things. I tried works. I tried leisure. I tried everything I can think of. And you know what happened to me? I got bored. I was thinking about that when it was talking about getting bored. And, you know, one of the wealthiest basketball players at one time, that may not be true now, was a man named Michael Jordan. Most everybody's heard of Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was probably considered one of the greatest basketball players of all time. And you remember that there came a place in Michael Jordan's life in which he said, I think I'm going to retire. And he retired. And then he decided he would try something different. I think that was baseball, wasn't that correct? And it just didn't work out for him. Because you know what? I got bored playing basketball, so I quit to try baseball. And I got bored playing baseball, so you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go back to basketball that I got bored with to begin with. He saw that it's just like that seeking in life after things that eventually do not bring any happiness at all. Now, here's the rest of the conclusion. To desire happiness is not wrong. There is nothing wrong with us desiring happiness. God wants us to have happiness. Now, not in the sense we think of happiness, but he wants us to find happiness. To want pleasure is not wrong. God does not desire that we not find pleasure in life. He created us. When he created Adam and Eve, he placed them in the Garden of Eden to enjoy the Garden of Eden. Pleasure. It's not wrong. Here it is. It is the source of our happiness and pleasure that makes the difference. It depends. What are you seeking your pleasure in? What are you seeking your happiness in? That makes the difference. In Romans chapter 1, most of y'all are familiar with that. That's a book that in the first chapter, it just goes through talking about God's wrath on the unrighteous. And what it says in Romans chapter 1 is this, down in verse 25, that God gave them up to the lust in their hearts, to impurity, to the dishonoring of their bodies among themselves. Then in verse 25 it says this, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator. What does that verse say? It says, here were people who, instead of seeking their pleasure in God, the Creator, they sought their pleasure in His creation. And it brought them emptiness, brought them despair, and it brought them ruin. Psalm 37, verse 4 says it this way, delight yourself in the Lord, and He will give you the desires of your heart. That, who are we supposed to delight in? The Lord. That's the one who should bring us delight. Psalm chapter 16, this, you might want to just jot this down in your margin there in your notes. Psalm 16, verse 11 says this, you make known to me the path of life. In your presence there is fullness of joy. At your right hand are pleasures forevermore. Where are we going to find true happiness and true pleasure? We're going to find it in God. That's what the psalmist is saying to us there. Most of you are familiar with Pastor John Piper. Pastor John Piper actually wrote a book called Desiring God, and the subtitle of it is Christian Hedonism. That's sort of odd to put those two words together, because we think that they're opposites to each other. He says this, it's not that we can't be pleased, in other words, by finding pleasure, but that we are pleased too easily. We are pleased by looking at things on the other side. You know, when I grew up, we had some cows, and the cows were always sticking their head through the fence. And it always was amazing because there'd be this lush green grass on the inside of the fence, and they'd stick their head through to eat the grass on the outside of the fence. Hence the old saying, the grass is greener on the other side. You know, that's sort of what you and I are like. We seek for looking for the grass that's greener on the other side. What John Piper says is this: it's not that we can't be pleased, but that we are pleased too easily. We are pleased and settle for the cheap trinkets instead of the divine pleasure with God. That what we're seeking for is pleasure in the things of life that are going to perish. How many things have you ever purchased in your life that now if you try to find it, either A, you can't find it, it's broken, or you've just given it away because it bores you? And that's what we seek our pleasure in. And yet God says you need to be seeking your pleasure in me. Delight in the Lord, and he will give you the desires of your heart.
Thank you for tuning in. If you're ever in the Griffin area, we would love to have you come visit us at 10:45 on Sunday mornings. Our location is 14550 Highway 19 South in Griffin, Georgia. I hope you have a wonderful day. And remember, God loves you.